Cecilia was sure Harris would graduate into a hunt soon, and perhaps into the greens in a week or so, but for now, all she wanted to think about was the hunt and the riding. If it wasn't opening day, with its farcical reproductions of ancient ceremonies via Surtees and Kipling, it was a hunting dawn. Cecilia put her head out the window and breathed deeply. Yes, cool enough, crisp and dry, and she would have a new mount today, a Buccinator Sun. Sometimes the gods rewarded you for virtues unknown. Bunny's staff served impeccable, lavish hunt breakfasts, and she enjoyed food. But today she hardly noticed either the traditional dishes or the taste. The green hunt, composed of the most experienced and best riders, talked little at breakfast this early in the season. Later, perhaps. Now they all wanted but one thing: the horses, the cold air, the speed, the chase. They recognized this in each other. Glance met glance over the clattering silverware. Outside, with the low sun gilding the stones, Cecilia walked down to the stable block as happy as she had felt since leaving competition. This is what life was about: a hot breakfast, comfortable in one's stomach, and the prospect of a good horse to ride over open country until the day ended. In her saddlebag was her personal choice for a lunch snack. On this, Bunny made no attempt to enforce the more foolish tradition. If you wanted a thermpack of shrimp and sweet sauce, you could have it. Cecilia favored a hot turkey sandwich, pickles and cheese, and hot coffee. Buccinator's son, powerful and alert, stood waiting, held by a groom. She mounted, picked up her reins, nodded to the groom, and set off at a walk to quarter the yard. Then out the great stone arch to the front of the main house, where Bunny and the huntsman would have brought the pack by now. She came around the side of the house. There in the sunlight were the hounds, sterns wagging as they swirled in controlled chaos around the hunt staff in scarlet. Bunny grinned as she rode up to him.
You like him, do you?
You stinker. You might have let me see him last year.
He wasn't ready. But you're first to take him into the field. He's been schooled, but never hunted.
You are most generous.
And he was. To let a guest take a green horse into the field, with the green hunt over the most demanding country, she was not sure she would have done it, had it been her horse and her country.
He couldn't be in better hands. One concession, we're going to start with the long tour foxes today.
That meant less woods riding, more in the open, but the fences were stone walls, unforgiving of mistakes, and in the open they'd be riding faster.
Sounds like fun.
Other riders came up then, paying their respects to the master, and she circled away. The long tour foxes cooperated by leading a long, circuitous chase across the open slopes, in and out of difficult ravines, back up and around, almost to their beginning. The Buccinator son proved himself, maturing at every wall and ditch, the scope and speed of Buccinator bloodlines keeping him out of trouble and well up. Cecilia didn't push him. There was no reason to race. Everyone knew how she could ride, and everyone knew the horse was green. Far more important to give him a good day's work and the confidence to go on another time. They rode back in a golden afternoon, the young horse still with power to spare, and Neil gave her a thumbs up when she came through the arch.
Cool and quiet, and not a mark on him. And you're happy with him?
He's all you promised. Never shirked, never tried to turn away from anything. He'd have gone faster if I'd asked. Actually, I had to hold him back at first.
Good. That's what I hoped for. He should be ready day after tomorrow. You can have old gossip tomorrow if you want.
Give him 2 days off. It's his first season. Flat work tomorrow, and the day after, I'll come do a little schooling on him when I get back from the hunt.
You think you'll have the energy?
Cecilia gave him a mock glare. He was always trying to suggest she was too old, but they both knew it was a joke.
I could school 3 horses now, as you well know. Shall I prove it?
No. Just give Gossip a run tomorrow. I let Cal have him for opening day, and he bucked over the first 10 fences, Cal said. Your friend Captain Serrano's doing well. I'm going to put her in the blues for her first run.
Cecilia came back to the house thoroughly satisfied.
Now, if only Harris and young Ronnie would realize how much fun this is.
Harris had spent several hours riding to Neil's exacting standard, on the flat and over the fences of the outside course. His announcement that she would ride in the blues was, she knew, a reward, though she would just as soon have had something more tangible and immediate. She came back to the house stiff, but not really sore, ready for a hot bath, but the house itself fascinated her. The big stone building was huge, an institution rather than a dwelling place. It had four levels above ground and one below, and an astounding number of rooms, corridors, staircases, arches, ramps, lifts, balconies, and other architectural bits for which Harris had no name. On the ground floor were rooms devoted to reading, sitting, talking, dancing, dining, lunching, breakfasting, and playing games of chance or billiards. High ceilings and large rooms made Harris think of an overdecorated flight deck on her cruiser. Most of the guest rooms were on the second floor, along with another library and a withdrawing room for women, which overlooked a rose garden. The third floor had both guest rooms and family suites, while the fourth was, traditionally, the servants' quarters. Harris had a bedroom the size of her entire suite on the yacht, with a bathroom almost as large as the bedroom. Two windows opened to the east, with a view across a lower roof to scattered buildings on green fields beyond. A white vase filled with fragrant roses stood on the black polished bureau. A desk comp stood beside it. The bathroom amazed her even more. It had every luxury fixture she'd heard of, and two she hadn't. She eyed the nozzles with suspicion and left them alone. She bathed, relaxed for a time in swirling hot water, and dried her hair, half amused at herself for taking so long. It was a very unmilitary situation. The same dress she had worn that first night at Tacoman Rhodes would do, Cecilia had said, for dinner. She added a simple but elegant silver necklace, then made her way through the maze of corridors to the main stair and descended its graceful curves. She felt as shy as she had the first night on a new ship, coming to the wardroom. Cecilia waited at the foot of the stairs, her short hair lifted into a graceful wave of silver and auburn. She wore the amber necklace Harris had admired, and a long beaded tunic in bronze and ochre over a flowing copper-colored skirt. It was hard to believe she was an old woman and had spent all day on a horse. She smiled.
"I thought you might like a few introductions."
"Thank you."
Harris had tried to form no expectations, but she was surprised. All the men in traditional black and white, all the women in long gowns, looked more like athletes than wealthy layabouts. Yet the surroundings and the clothes and the jewelry were straight out of caricature. She managed not to stare as a dark-haired beauty undulated by in a bundle of silvery silk, its folds seemingly held to her by affection alone.
"That's the Contessa. That's what she likes to be called, rather. It's all a sort of game, being a character out of history, or rather out of a story about history. They've read all the fiction of the period, and they take parts. Not formally, in the evenings, but one is expected to recognize a good version of a familiar character."
"Books? Like the Surtees and Kipling you loaned me?"
"That's a beginning. You'll have to look into Bunny's library. Come along. You need to meet him."
Harris tried to suppress her curiosity in the presence of her host, Lord Thornbuckle. Was he, too, taking a character to portray? Was that long, foolish face his by nature or by design? He murmured a greeting to her, a longer and warmer one to Lady Cecilia, along with his regrets that she had not made the opening day.
"We had some delays."
"So I understand from the children. How nice of you to have brought them along. Sorry, let's talk after dinner."
He turned to greet someone else, with a faint shrug that made clear to Harris he'd rather talk to Cecilia.
"And you must meet Miranda, his wife, Buttons and Bubbles' mother, though it's hard to believe. She takes rejuve like kittens take cream."
And, in fact, Harris would not have suspected the sweet-faced blonde to be old enough to have children Bubbles' age, let alone older ones. Miranda murmured polite nothings to them and introduced them to Colonel Barksley, who eyed Harris warily before wandering off to get something to drink, or so he said. Harris suspected he would go straight to a comp and start looking her up in some index of officers somewhere. She wished him luck. Harris had never been fond of the pre-dinner social hour anyway, and this one seemed to last forever. She felt out of place in these tall, cold rooms with their consciously ancient decorations, surrounded by people whose gowns had cost more than her fleet salary.
Dinner is served.
A flurry of movement. She found herself provided with a dinner partner, and felt fortunate to have read the Kipling, and soon sat at the long, polished table beneath the pseudo-baronial banners. Her partner, it seemed, was one of Bunny's distant cousins and desperately keen to hunt. Harris had no trouble with the conversation. The cousin wanted only a listener for his tale of the opening day hunt, today's hunt, the performance of his horse, the beauty of the weather, the cunning of the fox, and the inept handling of the hounds by the new huntsman. The food that came and went through all this was ample and hearty, not nearly as elegant as the meals Cecilia had served her, but more filling. Harris wondered if Bunny's household adhered to the custom of women leaving the table early, or to the more modern format where the heavy drinkers dispersed to one room and those preferring stimulants to another. The latter, she found. She went into the coffee room with some relief, for the long-winded cousin had chosen to drown his bruises in brandy.
You're ex-military, aren't you?
The colonel she'd been introduced to earlier was at her elbow.
You deserve a medal for endurance. Lawrence Boniface has rarely had such a patient listener. Most of the ladies gather their conversational reins at the beginning and try to make a race of it.
The food was too good.
And I thought it was recognition of a hopeless cause. Tell me, though, royals, regulars, or ground forces?
Regulars.
Ah, I met an Admiral Serrano once at an embassy due on Seychelles.
If he was 2 meters tall, with a scar from his left ear across his cheek, that was my Uncle Sabato. If she was my height, with lots of braids, it was my Aunt Vida.
Your aunt, then? Well, there's a strong family resemblance.
So I've been told.
It's unusual for regular fleet officers to have riding as a hobby.
Lady Cecilia would convert anyone. We had a wager which she won. The forfeit was that I would take instruction from her. In the process, I discovered an interest.
Ah. Do you know, years ago, when I was a small boy, I happened to see her ride, one of her professional events. It was cold and wet, I remember. Nasty blowing rain that went right through whatever you wore. I had been bored, even though I rather liked horses, because I couldn't see over the grown-ups. Then everyone was saying, "Here she comes!" And someone, I never even knew the man, set me up on his shoulders, and out of the murk came this huge horse with a red-headed woman on it, and they jumped something that looked to my child's eyes to be 4 meters high and every bit that wide. Of course it wasn't, but I was impressed anyway. For a whole term I wanted to be an event rider.
Were you ever?
Oh, no. I was too young to be faithful to dreams. The next thing I wanted to do was play a very rough ball game popular at our school. And since it was available, and good horses were not, I learned to play that and liked it. Real riding came later, but by then I knew I wanted a career in the military, or possibly security forces.
I wish I'd seen her. She's shown me the cubes, of course, but now that I've ridden a real horse, I can imagine that the effect is very different if you're actually there seeing it.
Magnificent. But do you have your hunt assignment yet?
Blue. Day after tomorrow, Neil said. Tomorrow I'm to have another session over fences.
Good for you. If he scheduled you in the blue, you're doing well. Let me introduce you to some of the other blue hunt members.
He led her to a cluster of people. Harris wondered which hunt he rode with. Cecilia had explained the system, but it seemed odd. For one thing, she didn't understand why the hunt levels didn't have names taken from the books instead of colors, if they were all so interested in reproducing history.
Ah, Captain Serrano, Lady Cecilia's new friend. We've heard about you. Neil's bragging to everyone, of course. She's his pet example of what we should all aspire to, and now as a teacher as well as a rider. Is it really true that you've never mounted a live horse until today?
Not at all. But it's true, I had ridden little, many years ago, and hadn't been on a horse since I was, perhaps 23.
You'd never jumped?
No.
I told you, Steph. Lady Cecilia's simulator is legendary.
That was a red-haired woman about Harris's height who wore a gown of mossy green with wide sleeves. Harris realized why when she saw the wrist brace.
Maybe it would help me. It took me 5 seasons to work up from the red hunt to the blue, and I've been stuck in blue for 10.
Tell me, did you find real horses easy after the simulator?
Not exactly easy, but much easier than I would have without it. And after the second ride, it was almost the same. A continuation of the same training.
Cecilia appeared at her shoulder. I hate to break this up, but you've got that early lesson, and I'm off with the Greens at dawn, and there's a message from the station. She smiled at the group around Harris, and they smiled in a way that let Harris know just how much clout Cecilia had. She was almost tempted to refuse the suggestion just to see them react, but that would be cheap. So she followed Cecilia upstairs.
Message?
Nothing much. The ones you left aboard.
The standing watch.
Whatever. Letting you know that the others arrived safely in Hospitality Bay, and that the new equipment is functioning correctly so far. Did you ask for regular reports?
Of course. If they didn't report, how would I know whether things are going well?
Oh, I'd assume they were. But before you even remind me, if it were a stable and not a ship, I would be the way you are. When I was off competing, I spent incredible sums checking back with the home yard to see if they'd remembered things. And they always had.
Because you checked. I'll call back up. Anything else?
Well, yes. I hope you won't be offended.
I won't.
Harris wasn't entirely sure. On her home ground, and she treated Lord Thornbuckle's planet as her home ground, Cecilia had some of the very habits Harris had feared when she first hired on with a rich old lady.
Some of them are terrible gossips. It's not just that they'll repeat what you've said. They'll embellish it. It'll be worse, because you're here as my guest. They've chewed my past to tasteless mush already, and you're something new. I know you can deal with it, but don't be surprised if you hear that we're lovers or something.
Lovers? Us?
Predictable gossip.
Harris realized that her reaction could be construed as unflattering.
I'm sorry, it's just... I mean...
We aren't, I know. But since I never married, they've been trying all the theories about why not, one after another, until the end and back again. That crowd that rides the Blue Hunt is the worst. Steph, in particular, would rather talk than ride, as you can tell when you see him mounted.
You know, I wouldn't talk about you, or Ronnie.
I know. It's not that. It's just, I want you to enjoy this, Harris. Not as my captain, but as my guest. And it occurred to me that you might not have their sort of gossip in the military.
Oh, don't we? Same both places, I expect. Don't worry. I can be dense when it suits me.
Good. If you pay attention in the Blue Hunt, you'll probably be up in Green very soon. They're looking for several things. How solid you are over fences, how dumb the horse comes back, and whether you interfere in the field.
Do you want me in the Green Hunt?
Of course I do. Heavens, girl, I wouldn't have brought you if I'd thought you'd be stuck in a lower hunt the whole season. It wouldn't have been fair to you, or as much fun for me. Go on now and get your rest. I'll be interested in hearing about your day.
That last visit to the tailor had taken out the slight wrinkle in the back of her jacket. Harris looked at herself in the mirror with a mixture of amusement and pride. Amusement because the clothing proper to fox hunting still struck her as ludicrous. Why wear light-colored tight breeches when you were going to gallop big dirty animals through the mud? And pride, because at over 40 she still had the condition to look 16 or so in those same tight pants, white shirt, and dark jacket. Despite the training and Cecilia's assurance that she was ready, Harris found the chaos in the Blue Hunt's meeting area tingling along her nerves. She looked for Neil, but saw only the second level of help.
Of course. Neil is with the Green Hunt. Surely he chose the mounts, though.
She eyed the big chestnut gelding being led toward her with some concern.
Tiger 2. Need a leg?
In a moment.
Harris went through the drill Cecilia had taught her, checking the bridle and girth herself, then accepted a leg and swung into the saddle. She hoped the beast's name did not reflect his temperament.
He pulls sometimes, but he'll answer a sharp check. Keep him back and calm, and he'll go all day. Get in a fight with him, and you wish you hadn't.
Great. She had a problem horse for her first hunt, her first performance in front of everyone. She looked down at the groom, expecting to see sly satisfaction, but the woman's smile was friendly.
Don't worry. He's not a bad un for the first time out. He can jump anything, and will. The only thing is, don't let him go too strong till he's worked himself down a bit.
Thank you. Any other advice?
Well, I wouldn't let him slow down in water. He likes to roll. If you come to a stream, get him over in a hurry.
I'll be careful.
The groom stepped back. Harris looked around and saw that about half the riders were up. She had room to walk the red horse, Tiger, in a small circle, and did so, first one way, then the other. As the minutes passed, she calmed down. It was just another horse, and they were going out to ride over just another field. She had told herself that same lie in other situations, and it always helped. The hounds led the way, their long tails. Harris couldn't make herself call such a biologic ornament a stern. Ships had sterns. Whipping back and forth or carried high, eager. She got only a glimpse of them before the rest of the field passed out the gate and blocked her view. She intended to make sure Tiger understood who was in charge while they were still at a walk. As they came around the end of the stable wing, Harris could see both the other hunts moving away to the east and west. The beginners, so Cecilia had called them, would hunt the flat, open country to the east, where the fences were lower and the pseudo-foxes lived in brushy thickets. The green hunt had the western hills, with long open slopes and timber at the top and bottom. And they, the blue hunt, had a mixed country, rather like lumpy potatoes in a kettle. Little hills with little creeks between them, little patches of woods and others of brush, odd-shaped fields bordered with stone walls or ditches or both. Verisimilitude, Cecilia had explained, influenced only some of Lord Thornbuckle's eccentricities. That rather lumpy country had been the first colony settlement on this world, bought out by one of the present owner's ancestors. They had tried to make a quick profit out of open-pit mining to pay off their initial investment, then botched the mid-level terraforming that was supposed to convert the area into something their heirs could live on and from. Instead, they went broke and left behind ugly pit mines, irregular heaps of spoil, ponds and wandering streams fouled with acid and heavy metals. Now, some hundreds of years later, the area was still unsafe for use in any food chain humans would use, but it could support hardy plants, animals with a tolerance for heavy metals and acid water, and recreation. Wool and leather and sport were its crops. Tiger yanked on the bit, and Harris brought her mind firmly back to the immediate moment. Someone trotted past. She found it hard to recognize, in the plain black coats and hats, the people she had met at dinner the night before, and the red horse wanted to follow. She refused, and met his attempt to sidle out from behind the horse in front with a firm leg. He tested her in the next few minutes, as they rode to cover, with a curvet here and a pretense at a shy there. She was reminded of certain troublemakers she had known and had no problem keeping him under control.
Ah, Captain Serrano!
The grinning man next to her was the tall, lanky blonde Cecilia had said liked talk better than riding. He was on a horse which looked like a stuffed caricature of the animal Neil had shown Cecilia. Large, dark brown, but this time coarse and bulgy instead of powerful and sleek. And he rode sloppily. Even Harris could tell that.
Lovely morning, isn't it? Are you ready for Tiger? Did they tell you?
That he pulls, yes. And to keep him out of the water.
Harris glanced around. They were near the tail of the group, and she could tell from the tension in the reins that Tiger wasn't happy about it.
You don't have to stay back here. Midfield's enough. Just keep him away from the leaders.
I'm fine. I like to watch the others.
Cecilia had told her to stay well back, even this far back, and she trusted Cecilia's advice more than someone who sat his horse like a jellied custard. Steph shrugged and kicked his horse into a trot. Harris anticipated Tiger's attempt to lunge forward and rehearsed for the 100th time what Cecilia had told her and what she had read. The hounds would be turned loose to find the smell, the scent, of one of the pseudo-foxes, and then they would give tongue. Now that Harris had heard them from a distance, she agreed that barked was inadequate. With the hounds following the scent, the field would follow, cautiously, because pseudo-foxes, like their old earth predecessors, were tricky beasts. More than once, they'd popped into view in the midst or even rear of the field, causing a wild confusion of horses and hounds and usually getting clean away. One had to give the pack time to work the scent, to untangle the maze the prey left, and push the fox into the open. Only when the fox was sighted did things move faster. Eventually, very fast. They came to a scrubby wood bordered on one side by a tangle of 2-meter brush. Riders gathered in a clump, most checking girths and stirrup leathers. Harris put a leg forward cautiously and found that Tiger's girth could come up another notch, just as the groom had said. She drew in a long breath of cold, moist morning air, on which the smell of horse and dog and wet clay hung suspended in a fundamental cleanliness utterly unlike ship's air. Planets felt so spacious. There always seemed to be room, somewhere beyond, although she knew very well they were as tightly limited as any ship, just larger. Something small and gray and bouncy, not a pseudo-fox, but something it probably ate, shot into the clearing and two horses shied away from it. Tiger threw up his head, but Harris held him firmly, and the little animal scuttered through the field without causing any real damage. Another animal, Harris got a good look at this one, and it was a small, black tree climber with a bushy tail, clung to a nearby tree. Around her, the riders gathered up reins and edged into position. Some began moving at a walk in the direction of the noise. For a long time, they seemed to move at a walk or slow trot, making their way through the woods and through a lane in the brush beyond it. Tiger tossed his head a lot, but otherwise gave Harris no trouble. At the end of the brush, a low stone wall offered the first chance to test jumping skills in the field. Harris, at the end of the field, had to wait a long time while others scrambled over, some with difficulty. By the time it was her turn, stones lay tumbled at the foot, and the wall was scarcely a half meter high. Tiger bounced over it with contempt, ears flat, and kicked up on the far side. Only those who had had refusals and turned aside to wait were behind her now. She could see the backs of the first riders rising as their horses leaped an obstacle across the field she'd just jumped into. Tiger fought the bit all the way across the field, took off late for the rail fence on its far side, and whacked it with his forelegs. Harris had no trouble staying on, but she could tell her shoulders would hurt if he was this stubborn all day long. The fence seemed to have settled him, though, for he followed the field along a track through sparse trees without trying to race ahead. Harris couldn't see exactly where they were headed next, but she felt more confidence in her ability to survive this odd ritual. Tiger's strong trot brought the field back to her, as most of the riders chose to squeeze through a gate at the end of the track rather than jump another higher wall. Some of those who had tried the jump hadn't made it. Harris saw one woman climbing back onto her horse, and a man stalking a loose horse, which was slyly moving off just too fast to be caught. Beyond the gate, they faced a sluggish stream, well muddied by recent crossings, and a steep slope across it up one of the small irregular hills. Remembering the groom's advice, Harris took a firm contact and gave Tiger a smart tap in the ribs. He plunged into the water and lurched up the far bank. Harris couldn't remember if she was supposed to avoid trotting uphill or down. Someone had said something about it, she thought. So she walked sedately up, trusting that she could see where everyone was from the top. Tiger's ears were no longer back. Apparently, he'd given up the fight. She had imagined a hill like an overturned bowl, with a definite top, from which she could see all sides. As soon as the slope flattened, she realized her mistake. She might as well have assumed that being at the top of a loading platform or the flight deck of her carrier would let her see everything going on below. From the irregular and unlevel top of the hill, the downward slopes were mostly invisible. Some fell off steeply, and others were hidden in clumps of trees or brush. She looked around for a clue. The ground had plenty of hoof prints, but she was no tracker to know which were recent. Far off in the distance, tiny horses stretched across the slope of another hill, but that couldn't be the hunt she was following. It was too far away. She hadn't heard the hounds for some time, she realized. She'd just been following the tail-end riders. She felt stupid and bored, and suddenly very irritated with Lady Cecilia. Surely this was not what riding to hounds was supposed to be like, dawdling along at the end of a group of people who fell off and got lost. How could they call it hunting? Only those in the front of the group were actually hunting, and they were just following the hounds, who were chasing a fake fox, an artificial animal designed to be quarry. The whole thing was a fake, a pretense of historical accuracy, modified for modern convenience. A quiver beneath her reminded her that she wasn't standing on a machine or a fake animal, but riding a real living animal with its own initiative. Tiger's ears were forward, pricked, and he stamped the ground with a forehoof. She looked in the direction of his gaze. The little horses had disappeared into a wood. Too far away still, she was sure, but Tiger didn't think so. She nudged Tiger into motion.
You like the hunt, they told me. Find the damned hunt, then.
Tiger picked up a trot, and as the downhill slope steepened, he lunged into a gallop. Harris had just time to think she shouldn't have let him do that. Then they were in the trees, and she was too busy keeping her head off limbs to worry about it. Tiger took the fence from trees to grass in an easy bound, crossed the field in 5 strides, and rolled over the wall at the far side into a track Harris had not noticed until they were in it. No trees. A long, curving ride up and around the shoulder of another hill, through an open gate, down across a grassy field. Tiger, wiser than she, skirted the rock-edged sinkhole in the middle and made for a gap he evidently knew well. A downward rocky slope where even Tiger slowed to a walk and Harris got her breath back as they slithered through some spicy-smelling trees toward another creek. That had been fun, if scary. She began to think that whether it counted as hunting or not, it was more fun to ride fast than slow. By this time, Harris had no idea where they were, but the horse's ears still pricked forward. He minced across the little creek and into the woods on the far side. Now that she was closer to the hounds, Harris had to admit they sounded almost like horns themselves. She gathered herself just in time as Tiger sprang upward, dodging through trees with no regard at all for her legs. She could steer him, she found, and even moderate his speed. She pulled him to a solid canter rather than a headlong gallop. They came out of the trees to find the hounds strung out on that hill's bald top, with the field close behind them and the fox in view before. Harris managed to swing Tiger around behind the front runners, though he fought her. Then they were in with the others, galloping over short grass toward what looked like a pile of rocks. The leaders swerved around it and poured over a wall just ahead of Harris. Tiger rose to the wall, and she got a quick glimpse of where they were going. The hounds, the streak of red-brown that must be the fox, the huntsman in red. Before they were into the next field, this one draped across the shoulder of its hill like a shawl. Tiger flattened beneath her, passing a gray horse and a black, and jumping the briars and stones that separated that field from another. His earlier exertions hadn't tired the red horse, and he was pulling her arms out. The leaders were nearer now, as Tiger thundered on, lunging against the reins, and his next jump put him even with the first of the field. Harris knew she should be holding him back, but excitement sang the last remnants of doubt out of her bones. She had not felt this exultation since. She pushed that away. Now, this horse, this field, this next jump was all that mattered. All in a clump they raced, angling across the field after the hounds to jump a sharp ditch. Someone fell there, but Tiger had carried her over safely. Ahead was another rock pile to which the fox sped and into which it vanished. The hounds swarmed over it, but they were not diggers, and the fox had found a safe lair. Harris got Tiger slowed, then circled him until he walked. He was wet and breathing hard, but clearly not exhausted. Nor was she. She hoped they'd find another fox and do it again. She could have laughed at her earlier mood. Boring, this? No, it was all Cecilia had promised. The huntsman set to work to call the hounds back and get them in order. Meanwhile, the rest of the Blue Hunt rode up. Some she had met, and some she hadn't. All now willing to speak to her and tell her how well she'd done.
Oh, you did splendidly.
I didn't really. I got lost, then the horse seemed to hear something.
Oh, but that's wonderful.
The woman had one wrist in a brace, and Harris realized it was the same one she'd seen at dinner.
That's what you're supposed to do. You actually caught up. Most people, once they're lost, spend the whole day wandering around without a clue, or give up and go home. Which hill were you on?
Harris looked around, but had no idea. The jumbled landscape looked as confused to her as a star chart probably would to these people.
It was near the beginning. There was a track through woods, then a creek, then a lot of tracks straight up the hill.
The goose egg? You got here in time for the final run from Goose Egg?
Now they seemed even more impressed. Harris wondered why. She thought of asking, but shrugged instead.
Tiger did it.
It was true anyway. He had known where to go, and he'd taken her there without any serious bruises. They liked that, she could see. Cecilia had told her that horse people expect riders to praise horses and take the blame themselves for errors. For a time, nothing much happened. The hounds stood panting, tongues hanging out. Some of them flopped down and rolled. Riders stretched or took a swallow from flasks in the saddlebag. A few dismounted and disappeared discreetly behind the rock pile. A few stragglers appeared, one by one, on lathered mounts. But perhaps a third of the field had disappeared. Harris wondered if they were going to look for another fox. It was still morning by the sun. When the hunt moved again, it was both calmer and more businesslike than the morning's first action. Harris felt the difference as a sense of purpose, as if a ship's crew steadied to some task. First, the huntsman took the hounds down the field toward a patch of woods near a stream. This one, Harris noted from the hillside, widened to a pond at one point. Riders rechecked girths and stirrups. Those who had dismounted got up again, and those who had been chatting stopped. Someone Harris didn't yet know put to her eye a most untraditional military-issue eyepiece. Harris wished she herself had had the wit to get one. That lucky soul would be seeing whatever she looked at in plenty of magnification and perfect lighting. She could see fleas on the fox's coat if a fox came out. Then the hounds found another trail. Tiger trembled. Harris steadied him, but didn't hold him back to the rear of the group this time. Steadily, without haste, the field moved toward the call at a brisk trot. This time, no one in front of Harris had a refusal at the low wall and ditch, nor did she, and they trotted on through the woods. Behind her, the bulk of the field stretched out. Out of the woods, she could see the scarlet coats ahead, the hounds now 50 meters in the lead across a field. Tiger wasn't pulling as badly, but her sentiments were with him now. She would like to have charged at the next field as fast as he would go. It had become more than the physical delight of riding over fences at speed. It was a hunt, and she wanted to be part of it. Now she could admit it to herself. She had not felt this completely alive, this exultant, since she'd commanded her own ship in combat. And that had been tempered with grief and worry, knowing that she risked her crew, people who trusted her. Here, she risked only herself. She had no responsibility for the others. No wonder people liked hunting. But she had no more time to think about it, and that too became part of the pleasure. That run, her first full run, remained a confusion in her mind when she tried to tell Cecilia about it. Field and wood and field succeeded each other too rapidly. She had to concentrate on riding, steering Tiger around trees, and readying herself for the fences, walls, ditches, banks that came at her every time she thought she'd caught her breath. It felt as if they'd been riding all day, a lifetime, when she realized that they'd caught the fox out in the middle of a vast open bowl between the hills, with a little stinking marsh off to one side. This time, Tiger was willing to stop. She sat, hoping she would not disgrace herself by slithering off his back to lie in a heap on the ground. Breath and awareness came back to her even as the rest of the field came up.
You can ride. Don't tell me it's all that horse. I've ridden him myself.
In the hunting frenzy of Lord Thornbuckle's establishment, Ronnie saw his companions change. Buttons, who had been growing perceptibly stuffier over the last year, became a proper son of the household and took over the red hunt without complaint. He seemed almost a parody of his father, despite the difference in looks. Sarah simply vanished. When they asked, Buttons looked down his nose and muttered something about wedding preparations. Ronnie wished he had such a handy excuse. The others had to undergo evaluation by the head trainer. A humiliating experience, Ronnie thought. Rafaela rode better than he'd expected. Though the trainer complained about her form, she never fell off, and was passed to the Blue Hunt after only a week's review. He and George and Bubbles, though, were stuck with two daily lessons. Ronnie hated the lessons. They spent nearly all the time at a walk or trot, with a sharp-voiced junior trainer nagging them about things Ronnie was sure didn't really matter. The trainer wasn't nearly as hard on Bubbles. He figured that was favoritism toward a family member. Afterwards, on the way back to the house to swim or play chip ball, Bubbles would critique his lesson again, in detail. She was supposed to be his girlfriend, but she'd been acting as if he were a nuisance. The crisp, Clear weather of the first few days ended with a cold front, clouds and drizzle. It made no difference what the weather was. Lessons and hunts went out on schedule. Ronnie hated the cold trickle down the back of his neck, the horrid dankness of wet boots, and he didn't want to get used to it.
Oh, tradition be damned. Why can't we wear proper weather-sensing clothing like the Royal Service does on maneuvers?
At dinner each day, the main house crowd seemed to divide naturally along hunt lines. The Greens, his Aunt Cecilia, quite prominent among them, had their favorite rooms and corners, and so did the Blues. The Reds condescended subtly to those not yet assigned, but knew their place compared to the other hunts. Bubbles left them, pointedly showing off, Ronnie thought, her ability to mingle with ease as well as her white shoulders. The only young women among the unassigned were too young for him and too gawky. A pair of earnest cousins so obviously overawed by their surroundings that they blushed if anyone came near. When Captain Serrano showed up with a foxtail one evening, he was supposed to call it the Brush, after her first hunt with the Blues, Ronnie was disgusted. He had spent 5 hours that day riding 3 different horses in boring circles, trotting over boring little fences in a boring ring. He'd been told he might be allowed on the outside course in a couple of days if he concentrated. And she, 20 years older if a day, had been allowed to skip the Red Hunt altogether, go into the Blues, and had had a good first hunt. It wasn't fair. For the first time since his lessons on the ship, he thought of revenge, but he resisted. It wasn't worth it. His only solace in these trying days was Rafaela, of all people. George dragged her away with a group of Blues one night and gave a humorous account of their day's lessons. Ronnie felt humiliated. He didn't fall off that often, and George didn't mention any of his own mistakes. But Rafaela's glance at him was sympathetic. After that, she came of her own accord every evening for a few minutes at least. She asked once where Bubbles was, and Ronnie shrugged. She asked no more, but he noticed that she talked to both of them, not just George. And when George was taken up by a group of older men who knew his father, Rafaela kept coming, chatting quietly with Ronnie in a way he found more and more soothing. By the time Ronnie finally got his pass to hunt with the Reds, 2 days before George, a minor triumph, which by then he didn't enjoy, he expected no pleasure. The morning dawned murky and cold, with vague clots of mist hiding the low places. Ronnie felt stiff before he even got to the stables. Buttons, spruce and cheerful, grinned at him as he stumped into the yard where the hunt gathered. He wore the red coat and insignia of the MFH of the Reds, and looked as if he'd been born in it.
Ha! Good for you! I knew you'd beat George out of the lesson pit. It's a good day for scent, anyway.
Oh, George will be along soon enough. Where's Bubbles?
Taking a vacation. She is riding with the Blues today. We decided George could survive without a family member for one lesson.
This reminder of his situation did not help. Ronnie looked around again. A groom waved to him, and he went over to get on the dark, heavy animal that was his for the day.
Thumper is good, solid, reliable, and not too fast. Bring him home safe.
Ronnie noticed nothing was said about his safety. They rode out into the cold murk. Thumper seemed to think his place was in the back of the field. Ronnie kicked vigorously and got him up to the middle. They all milled around in a wet meadow while the hounds cast about for a scent. No one spoke to Ronnie, and he knew they were all eyeing him. His neck felt hot. When the hounds began to speak, he urged Thumper in that direction, but the others were faster. He trotted along near the back of the group, getting well spattered with mud the other horses kicked up. Thumper slowed, and Ronnie couldn't blame him. After a while, the horses ahead of him sped off at a canter. Ronnie followed. Now the mud flew higher. He could see it spattering the ground ahead of him. A hedge appeared from the murk, and Thumper lifted to it. On the far side, a ditch gaped. Thumper stretched, and Ronnie clung, slipping a bit at the rough landing. But he regained his seat and urged Thumper on through a flat field after the others. He wished someone had seen. It was a larger jump than he'd ever taken in a lesson. After some minutes of this, he was breathless and sore. It was much harder than the lessons, even the ones on the outside course. He couldn't tell what kind of obstacle was coming. There never seemed time to plan an approach to get himself ready for the jump. Thumper had a rough, lumbering stride, and while he jumped safely, never hitting anything, he took off with a lurch and landed hard each time. Ronnie was doing better than some. He had seen riders sprawled on the wet ground, loose horses, people remounting, but he couldn't get Thumper to catch up with the field. Thumper knew that signal and churned ahead faster. Now they passed stragglers, riders whose strained faces showed that they found this as tiring as Ronnie did.
Why do they bother? Are there that many bossy aunts in the universe?
He saw a rail fence coming up and braced himself. They were over safely, but another loomed up. Ronnie grabbed mane and survived that one, too. Thumper plunged on into the rear of the slowing field. The dogs had caught the fox, though Ronnie couldn't see it. He pulled on the reins and Thumper slowed to a walk, then stood, sides heaving. No one seemed to notice them now. The red-coated hunt staff in the center were doing something. The crowd spread out as the riders walked their horses slowly around. Thumper heaved a great sigh and shook his head a little. Ronnie noticed others getting flasks out of their saddlebags. He started to reach for his and remembered that he'd forgotten to bring it. It seemed suddenly darker, and the first cold drops of the day's rain splashed his hot neck. By nightfall, Ronnie had ridden too many hours, fallen off twice. Both times, some helpful stranger caught Thumper and brought him back, and was wet to the skin with both sweat and rain. His throat felt raw, his nose was running, and his knees and ankles felt as if he'd played the finals of some dismal professional sport involving large, angry men pounding each other to mush. He managed to stay on Thumper until he guided him through the gates of the yard, and then slithered off, staggering as he landed.
Do you need assistance?
The groom was already pampering Thumper.
I had a fall, but nothing's broken.
She turned, leading the horse away.
It's a good day, then, if nothing broke.
He stumped up to the house, hoping to make it to a hot bath without meeting anyone. But of course, there was George, dapper and witty, with Raffaella on his arm.
What did you fall into, the pig pen?
Ronnie was glad to note that Raffaella did not smirk. She was dry and clean and lovely, but she did not smirk.
Just a muddy ditch.
I haven't fallen off in a week, even though it really rained hard during my second lesson today.
It's different out there.
Ronnie shot a glance at Raffaella. She wasn't even smiling. She looked as if she knew that his shoulder and hip hurt and was sorry.
I'll bet Bubbles and Rafa didn't fall, did you?
Rafa turned an enchanting shade of pink. Ronnie had never thought how lovely a blush could look against dark hair.
Almost. My horse stumbled on landing over a big drop, and I was right up on her neck.
But you didn't fall. Now, if that had been Ronnie, he'd have gone splat, right?
Excuse me, I'd like to take a bath before dinner.
Well, I should hope so. You certainly need one.
Ronnie fumed his way to his room.
I simply cannot spend the entire winter at this ridiculous sport. I have to get away somehow and do something where I don't feel a complete fool. I'm not sure this is a good idea.
Do you really want to spend another day bouncing around on that horse?
Of course Ronnie didn't. That was the point. It had been bad enough before George got into the hunt, and worse afterwards.
You look ridiculous on a horse.
I do not!
Ronnie glared at his friend. George had not fallen off in his first time in the field, and it had gone to his head. He seemed to think a successful maiden appearance made up for later runaways, buckings off, and an inability to keep up with the field on a slow day.
I ride better than you.
And not nearly so well as your aged aunt or that demon captain of hers. Honestly, I had no idea the rakes went in for horse riding. I thought they spent all their time polishing weapons and doing drills.
They do love drills, don't they? At least down here, Captain Serrano can't interrupt our sleep.
No. That's the purview of your aunt, waking us up before daylight to gobble a disgusting breakfast and clamber onto great clumsy, smelly animals.
Ronnie felt a perverse desire to insist that it wasn't that bad. Bubbles patted him on the shoulder as she clambered past him.
And you did look so funny, Lamb, when you were stuck in that hedge, all red-faced and blubbering. Just Bubbles.
Fine.
Ronnie slid the canopy forward. The others were still stowing their supplies in the lockers. He was beginning to wish he hadn't agreed to this, but how could he back out now? He called up the pre-flight checklist on the display and started down it. The computer would have done everything, of course, but he was not as careless as his aunt thought.
Come on, Ron. Get this thing off the ground.
Pre-flight. You should know that, George.
Ronnie worked his way down the rest of the pre-flight list in silence. As usual, everything seemed to be in order. He inserted the cube and checked the readout. It had accepted his course programming and calculated fuel consumption based on satellite weather information.
Refuel once. Anyone care if it's Bandon or Kalu?
Bandon.
Ronnie entered that with the touchpad, cast a glance back to make sure all the loose items were stowed, and pressed the green button. The engines caught, and the computer took over the final pre-flight power checks. At least he knew what the readouts meant, though he could not, from this point on, override the computer's decisions. Not much like a royal trainer. These civilian models would fly themselves, given the chance. He laid his hands lightly on the yoke anyway, and punched for manual takeoff. He felt the yoke quiver, and the computer displayed his options. If he stayed within these margins, he could have control. And within those, he could control one axis. For a moment, it amused him. For a human to be allowed to fly the machine, he had to fly like a machine. It would be practice, and he had always enjoyed flying. He flicked his fingers over the yoke studs. Power, directional focus, attitude. And the computer agreed that he knew what he was doing. He didn't know if the others noticed, but he had manual control until he chose to relinquish it, when the craft was at 5,000 meters and on course to Bandon.
It's dark outside. There's nothing but the house lights.
We had to leave before daylight, or Ronnie's aunt would have stopped us.
Ronnie tried to see past the reflections on the canopy. Nothing but darkness. He flicked off the interior lights and looked harder. Nothing ahead but darkness. Nothing to either side but darkness. He'd never seen anything quite so black in his life.
It'll be dawn soon, and the computer doesn't need daylight.
As it came out of his mouth, he realized that they knew that. He was comforting himself. Darkness hid his blush. Behind him, someone turned on one of the tiny reading lights, a soft glow in the rear of the cabin. Ronnie left the main cabin lights off. He found that he kept looking to the right, hoping to see some glimmer of dawn. Just when he had given up hope, and convinced himself that he would have to endure flying down a black drainpipe forever, a sullen glow lit the horizon, more feeling than color. Soon he was sure of it. A dim redness blotched with black, clouds, he realized, and then a curious, fuzzy quality to the outside. Still dark, still impenetrable, but somehow seeming larger than it had. As the light strengthened, he saw the sea beneath, oddly brighter than the sky. Away towards sunrise it stretched, and the clouds hung over it in dark columns, their tops flushed pink now with the coming light. Ronnie had never flown along a coast at sunrise. He had not imagined the impossible combinations of green and blue and purple, the piles of pink and gold, which clouds and sea and sunrise make. He looked down on the dark land slowly coming out of the dark haze of night, the shoreline edged with ruffles of colorless surf that would soon be silver and blue. His quick memory for maps told him they were almost a third of the way to Bandon. The computer would soon change their course away from sunrise, across the narrowing belt of land and out across the ocean to that cluster of islands. He hoped it would not change before he could see the sun lift out of the sea.
There's nothing down there at all. Where are we?
Oh, this is the bottleneck. Oh, gorgeous morning, especially since I don't have to climb on a horse. Oh, don't worry, Rafa, we can't get lost. The computer on this thing has a direct line to the Navsat. If we went down, someone would be there in no time.
But somebody must live somewhere.
On up the coast a bit, there's a settlement of wildlife biologists. They're to keep the stuff we don't want out of the hunt ground.
The sun came up and glittered on the surf just as Ronnie had imagined. And a few minutes later, the computer swung them left, away from the coast, and across the forested bottleneck. Bubbles served breakfast, pastries and fruit and hot coffee she'd filched from the kitchen before they left. Ronnie stretched, enjoying the comfort of baggy trousers, loose shirt, and low, soft-sided boots after the confines of hunting attire. By the time they'd eaten, they'd crossed the other coast and were headed across a blue, wrinkled ocean toward the islands. Ronnie had nothing to do, so he turned his seat around and listened to the girls speculate on when Bunny would send someone after them.
I hope it's not Aunt Ceci.
Oh, he wouldn't send her. She's a guest. It will probably be some boring mid-level administrator.
We could just tell your father, once we get there, that is.
No. You don't know how he is. He'll lecture me, I'll get mad, we'll argue, and then I'll have to make up. Or he will. And that takes time I could be enjoying with you.
Ronnie put the landing system on automatic when he thought they were in range of Bandon. It would contact the field and bring them in without his intervention, though he hoped the computer would allow him a manual landing. When the comm beeped and the field authorization light turned red, he assumed that the field wanted a voice contact. It seemed a reasonable way to keep out unwanted guests.
Any special code words?
No, just give the flitter number. It's on the family list.
Bandon Field. Permission to land and refuel. Number 002413.
Permission denied.
Ronnie stared at the computer display. He had never heard of a civilian field refusing permission to land and refuel.
Bandon Field. Permission to land and refuel. Number 002413. We're low on fuel, Bandon Field.
Permission denied.
Override that. Put in Landsman 78342 and see what happens. That's Father's personal code.
Ronnie poked at the screen and hit the orange override button.
Permission denied.
Can we make Kaloo from here?
Just barely, but I don't see why we should. This is Bunny's flitter, and Bubbles just gave us the internal authorization number. If it won't accept it, something's wrong.
We don't want to land if something's wrong. What could be wrong? What's on this island anyway, Bubbles?
Well, the landing field, maintenance station, and the family's lodge, and no resident staff, though.
There's a lodge here, too? Then why did you tell me to program for White Wings?
We wanted to be out of everyone's reach. This is too close. This is the first place they'd look.
Ronnie looked out the canopy. Heavily wooded islands lay scattered in odd shapes across the sea. Bandon, the computer readout told him, was a half hour ahead. He could see its distinctive shape beyond the nearest island. Kaloo, the northernmost of the chain, lay far to their right.
We ought to find out what's wrong. We'll go on to Bandon and take a look.
They could still make Kaloo if they had to, and if they found out something important, Bunny might forgive their disappearance. With the vague notion that he was being careful, Ronnie let the flitter drop lower and skimmed just above the forest, following the contours with care, then made a low approach across the sea, between that island and Bandon, edging past a smaller island not quite in his path between them. He did not look outside, concentrating instead on his instruments. If he dipped too low, the flitter's automatic safety overrides would lower the plenum and convert it to an airboat. That could be most embarrassing. George saw the danger first.
Look out!
Ronnie looked back at him, wondering what kind of game they were playing back there. Then he saw it, just before it struck, an odd shape trailing a line of orange smoke. The flitter jerked itself out of his control, bouncing up and sideways, and a good half of the readouts went red. Ronnie grabbed the controls back, felt the ominous mushiness, and went into the emergency landing sequence he had never expected to use once passed his piloting exam. The airspeed readout, like all in that bank, was dead. The white beach and green trees ahead moved nearer too slowly. Behind him, no one spoke. George clambered forward, disturbing the flitter's precarious balance, and dropped into the other forward seat.
I think it was a signal rocket. All that red smoke.
She's nose heavy, and the hydraulics are shot. Use that big foot on the floor, not your mouth.
Whatever George did made no difference. The flitter sank toward the waves.
Brace up, you girls.
Brace up yourself, gee. We're trying to get the raft out.
Ronnie tried once more to pull the nose up, but the flitter shivered all over like a nervous dog. Flitters don't stall, he remembered being told, but they crash all the same. It occurred to him that even if they made it to land, he might simply crash head-on into the lush forest. Could he maneuver at all? Altitude, then maneuver, he remembered. But he had no altitude. He tried. The flitter slewed sideways, but answered sluggishly. He could parallel the coastline and those trees.
George! There! Those people!
Ronnie did not look. He had to keep the flitter in the air as long as he could. George leaned to see.
Naked, but armed. I think that's the launcher he hit us with.
Ronnie put all his strength into willing the flitter not to crash into a lump of trees nearer shore than the rest.
Hunting Party will be concluded in part 2. The Serrano Legacy Hunting Party is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2002 Elizabeth Moon. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2008 The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Nanette Savard, Colleen Delaney, David Coyne, Terence Aselford, Richard Rowan, Michael John Casey, Christopher Graybill, Sonny Lasky, M.B. Van Dorn, Tess Rowan, Thomas Penny, Dylan Lynch, James Lewis, James Konacek, and Mort Shelby. Directed by Nanette Savard. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Chris Rowan. Additional original music by Chris Rowan. If you enjoyed Serrano Legacy, be sure to look for the Deathstalker series, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net.